shared desire for peace and the spirit of cooperation. On one hand, I was all for those concepts. On the other hand, I was too cynical to believe any of it, at least in this circumstance. This same president had 2 days ago accused the leader seated next to him of some truly vile human rights violations. So, they were selling the usual pack of platitudes and lies. Mind you, if the nine nations actually did reach a true binding denuclearization agreement, I'd give them all foot massages and sloppy kisses, but I've never known politics to move at the speed of common sense or simple truths. "What have you got, Bug?" I asked, once more stepping away from the crowds. "We hijacked the feeds from the hotel's security cameras and, the private body cam feeds from most of the teams on site."
"I won't tell Santa Claus you've been naughty."
"We found a couple of anomalies which we'll sort out," said Bug. "But one bothers me. When you were talking to the blonde gal, there were other maintenance around, the ones who stopped with her and more. I saw them. What did you find?" "There's one we can't match to any staff records. She had black hair, a little heavy."
"What about her?"
"The facial recognition software kicked out a possible match with the gal we're calling Eve. Not a high percentage, though. 47%. I mean, she could be wearing a wig and padded clothes. Padding could be just that, or body armor, or something else."
I tapped the comms earpiece to bring the rest of Havoc onto the call. "Scout," I ordered, and we all put on aviator glasses with a subtle tint. The left temple piece was a Bluetooth receiver that sent data and images to one lens. The surveillance photo of Eve was there, next to the blurry image of the black-haired woman. The computer began pinging corresponding facial orientation points and measurements.
"Close," said Andrea, "but I would not bet my retirement on it."
"Let's find and detain her," I said. "Sweep the building, Bug. See if you can pick her up on the camera feeds."
"Been looking, but so far nothing."
"Starting to get that itch between my shoulder blades," said Top.
"Right there with you," I said. "Let's find her. In the meantime, Bug, pull up the maintenance logs. The woman I spoke with and her friends were heading to the press room to fix some speakers. The black-haired woman was heading toward the service corridor. Where were they heading?" I walked while I waited, using my height to look above most of the crowd.
"Outlaw," said Bug. "They were checking on one of the HEPA filters in the main hall. There was a rattle that was being picked up on the mics. I'm scanning that area now to see if she's around."
Suddenly, Scott Wilson's voice broke into the call.
"Outlaw, Outlaw, we have urgent intel.
Go for Outlaw."
"We just received word from the assistant director of Kingdom. He said that Major Mann is alive and contacted him via satellite phone. She was held as a prisoner aboard a motor sailor, the Soul of Piety, which is currently moored in the Kiel Canal on the River Elbe. She described one of her abductors, and it is a perfect match to Rafael Santoro. The others were fixers. She got free, eliminated three fixers, and called it in."
"That's great, but the River Elbe? Why is she even in this part of the damn world?"
"Outlaw, that's the critical thing. Munn found equipment and samples of identification badges and a contact lens maker which can imprint new retina patterns. This is high-end stuff, and Outlaw, the passes are for the D9.
I finished. Jesus Christ.
And then everything hit me. All of it. In a microsecond, all of those jumbled puzzle pieces flapped down on the table and fell into place. The lab in Syria. The poor bastards in the glass cages being sprayed by some chemical mist. How crazy they went. What I'd first thought was fear and anger and a desperation to escape that hellish lab now meant something entirely different. The flies at the cafe in Turkey were the same as those on the islands. An aerial drone delivery system. That's why the customers went nuts. They weren't Santoro's men. They were civilians turned into weapons. I looked around, seeing everything as if with new eyes. There were no bugs in a place like this. A single fly would be noticed. Everything was clean and sanitized and prepared for the presence of nine world leaders. They wouldn't tolerate flies in here. I looked in the direction of the service hall. The maintenance crew had gone to fix the air filters. The big hall was right around the corner, 60 feet from where I stood. Pieces falling into place created a much bigger picture. Air. Mist. A delivery system appropriate to the venue. Flies for an island or a small cafe, but for a place with high security and filtered air? Suddenly I was running. "It's airborne," I yelled. "Wilson, clear the conference room. It's the air filtration system. Shut it down. Christ, shut it down. They have an airborne version of rage." I barely had those words out when all of the lights everywhere in the hotel went out. Chapter 130 D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. My run turned into a blundering collision as people did what people do. They panicked. There was reflected light from the big glass windows, but it was around the curve of the hall behind me, leaving everything in front of me in roiling shadows. This room had been chosen, partly because there was no direct window access, no vantage point for a sniper to shoot through the glass. As I pushed and yelled and fought my way in the direction of the big room, "Where the hell are the security lights?" I bellowed, but all I got was static on the comms unit, another damn jammer. I heard other security people yelling into their sleeves or lapel mics in a dozen languages. Reporters and others who'd gathered in the hall to watch on the monitors were yelling and demanding explanations. There were grunts and curses and a sharp yelp of pain as someone fell or was stepped on. It was the Tower of Babel in near total darkness. Then some pale battery-operated security lights came on. None very close to the conference room doors, though. Were the closer ones sabotaged? Of course they were. We were in a no-coincidence zone. Small lights flicked on, people with cell phones and some presence of mind. I could just make out the closest door where four agents were clustered together to block the entrance with their bodies. They had not yet drawn weapons. "PST," I snapped, using the shorthand for Politietsikkerhetstjeneste, the Norwegian Police Security Service. I held the badge up and one of them peered at it and me. "What is happening?" he demanded. "Power is out and all radio communication is down," I said. "Cell phones will be down too. It's a jammer." His hand flashed to the butt of his pistol. "Is this an attack?" "I think so. Get the Prime Minister to safety. We need to pass the word to the other security teams. Get me inside. Now." The man turned and pushed past his comrades. He pulled the door open and I followed him into the big hall. Inside, it was a little calmer, and there were flashlights and cell lights. The world leaders were down, pulled to safety, and surrounded by their teams. Supervisors were yelling to the crowd to settle down, to remain in their seats. It was a shelter-in-place solution for what everyone in there probably thought was a bad and very unfortunately timed technical glitch. The news people had the brightest lights, driven by power packs on tripod-mounted cameras. These played on the 9 clusters of world leaders.
"Outlaw! Outlaw!"
yelled a voice, and I half-turned to see Top and Bell come hustling through the same door I'd used. I hurried along the side aisle, following the guard. I held my badge up and yelled the security crisis evacuation word for the day. "Longship! Longship! Longship!" The security team leaders immediately went into action, rising, yelling orders, shaping each exit huddle and pushing them toward their assigned evac routes. A scream, huge, towering, shrill and filled with madness, tore its way across the big room, and even in the midst of evacuation, everyone turned. By the side wall, a Pulitzer Prize-winning, internationally famous reporter for BBC News grabbed a shoulder-mounted news camera from her assistant, swung it into the face of the senior political analyst for Al Jazeera. It was a murderous attack, savage and fast, and the analyst's face broke apart in a spray of blood. That's when I saw the vent above where the BBC reporter stood. In the glow from all those small lights turned in that direction, I could see the millions of tiny droplets of mist shooting into the room at high speed. God, I hated to be right. All around the reporter, people began twitching, growling, snarling, howling. They turned on one another, baring their teeth, grabbing anything they could, cameras, microphones, pens, clipboards, or used their bare hands and snapping teeth. The room became a madhouse of murder and death.
Chapter 131. D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. I saw the security huddle around the Chinese president moving toward the left stage exit. Two of the guards rose up, guns in hand, and led the way while another pair faced the rioting crowd. They were making good time and covered their leader so well I couldn't see him at all. The other groups were shifting toward the sides, all of them looking like bizarre turtles. Until one of the PST officers ran onto the stage, drew his pistol, and opened fire at the Chinese guards. Six fast shots and both of the guards in the lead crumpled backward, blood splashing their team members and their huddled principal. The knot of Chinese guards, as a unit, flinched back, confusion colliding with training. Then the Norwegian fired directly into them, trying to get the president. One of the Chinese shot him, but missed because of jostling, and a second later took a round in the throat. By then, I was at the rostrum, put a hand on it and vaulted up onto the stage, pulling my own gun. The Snellig wasn't lethal, but it was fast, and I yelled at the Chinese, telling them that I was a friendly, as I fired two shots at the Norwegian. He went down. Top and Bell spun and put their backs to the stage, facing the crowd. They were far enough away from the wall vents that most of the people around them were not infected by the rage protein. But a Pakistani reporter suddenly pulled a pistol and began firing indiscriminately at the huddled groups on the stage. I cut a look at him and saw no trace of madness in his eyes, no face of rage. "Fixer," I yelled, and Bell swung toward him and shot him with a Sandman dart. As if that was a call to arms, gunfire erupted all through the room, and it seemed like everyone was shooting at everyone else. Security guards of different nations opening up to kill other guards in an attempt to get clear shots of the world leaders. There was no way at all to tell who were good guys and who was a bad guy. A third of the room was tearing itself apart as the vents continued to spew rage onto the crowd. Top and Bell were turning and firing, and there was no way to know if the targets they dropped were fixers, people driven mad by fear, or victims of rage. I thought about how much ammunition we each had. One magazine in our guns, two extra mags. That was it. Not enough. Not nearly enough. I spun in place, looking at the nine huddles. More gunfire was coming from off stage, both sides. Guards went down, the huddles shrunk. The fixers clearly wanted the world leaders to stay in the hall. Above me, I heard a metal clunk and a sharp hiss and looked up in horror to see dense vapor begin shooting from a vent directly above the stage. "Cover your mouths!" I roared, first in Chinese, because they were closer, and then in English, Korean, and every other language I could manage. "Get out from under the vent, they're spraying a bioweapon. Move! Move!" I fired at fixers and shoved security people. I could see the American president hunkered down, Secret Service body blocking him. He looked terrified. Couldn't blame him. I was scared out of my mind because everything was falling apart, and I did not see a single path to safety. The fixers backstage were kneeling behind some equipment cases they'd pushed into place to act as a shooting blind. If the huddles stayed where they were, they would be torn apart. If they moved, they'd be sprayed by the rage. Abruptly, one of the guards from the Indian huddle stood up, pressed the barrel of his gun against the temple of the man next to him, and fired. The bullet took off the top right corner of the victim's head and then punched into the cheek of the guard next to him. Things went to shit from there. The gunman wasn't a fixer. His insane and inarticulate howl told the awful truth. He was driven out of his mind beyond sanity and had become a creature of pure rage. I shot him with Sandman and he went down, but then I was staggering back from a mule kick as two rounds hit me, center mass. The vest saved my life, but the impact knocked the air from my lungs and drove me to the edge of the stage. I pinwheeled my arms for balance, and only by dropping into a low crouch did I keep from flopping down into the screaming crowd. Even then, I tottered, and then something caught me. I twisted to see Bunny there, propping me up. Andrea was behind him, and soon the four Havoc team members had formed a defensive half-circle hard against the edge of the stage. I crouched above them.
"We don't have this, outlaw!"
yelled Top.
"There has to be a shut-off switch somewhere," said Andrea. "We need to turn the whole air conditioning system off, or this will get through the entire building."
"The power is out," growled Bunny.
"There has to be a battery backup. Maybe I can—"
"Havoc!"
roared a voice, and I turned to see three fixers stagger out from stage right. They were stumbling, bleeding, dying, and they fell, as Mr. Church came striding out. He had no gun, but was instead armed with a short piece of pipe. God only knows where it came from. Church waded into the other fixers, and for a moment, I just stared. I've rarely seen the big man in action, and it was always an awesome sight. He is much faster than you'd expect a man of his size and age to be, and he moved with an almost clinical precision. Nothing wasted, nothing flashy. His movements were quick, brutal, and constant. Wilson was right behind him, a Snellig dart gun in his hand. Wilson was bleeding from a bad gash through his right eyebrow and cheek.
"This way!"
yelled Wilson, but then he took one step too far onto the stage and the mist got him. A drift of particles dancing in the air sucked in after he cried out to try and show the way to safety. There was one frozen moment when I could see his face change. The eyes went empty for one blink, and then they filled with something hot and red and wild. He turned and fired his gun at Church, and although it seemed as if the dart struck the big man in the chest and side of the neck, Church did not drop. Instead, he stepped into Wilson, quickly twisted the dart gun from his hand, and shot Wilson in the cheek. Bell had climbed onto the apron of the stage and was firing over the heads of the huddles toward the fixers on stage left. Bullets burned around her as she drew their fire, but her accuracy was chilling. One after another of them dropped.
"Donnie Darko, Pappy, jackpot," I shouted. "Focus on the infected. Stop them before they can hurt people. I'll see if I can find the shutoff."
"We're running out of time," warned Andrea.
I looked for the best route out of the madness. It was a tough call because we needed shooters in the gunfight, but at the same time, we were there to protect the innocent, which meant stopping the flow of rage throughout the crammed hotel. At the moment, it looked like we were going to fail in both fights. Church began grabbing guards in the Chinese huddle and propelling them towards stage right.
"It's clear behind me all the way to the safe room," he bellowed. "Get your president to safety. Go, go, go!"
One of the guards began twitching and abruptly swung on Church, but then the man fell and I had the wrong angle to see what Church did to him. Whatever it was damn fast.
"It's rage," I hollered in Church's direction. "Cover your mouth and nose."
Church nodded and plucked his pocket square out and pressed it to his face. I heard him telling the survivors of the Chinese huddle to do the same. They used ties and sleeves. The president buried his face in a handful of a guard's jacket. Would that be enough? I hoped so. The rage protein was a vapor, so unless it got into a mucous membrane, it shouldn't be a danger. Eyes, though. They were a vulnerable spot, but there was nothing we could do except try not to be sprayed there. The situation was this. The nine huddles were on the big stage. The stage left exit was blocked by a fixer fire team, but their angle was bad for wholesale slaughter because of how far off stage they were. Only when someone tried to escape did they come into a merciless line of fire. The right-hand exit was clear, but to get there the huddles would pass under the spray from one vent. Off stage, the riot was expanding as the bioweapon poured from vents on all the walls. There was a relative safe zone in the orchestra pit, but it was already overcrowded. Infected people were hurling themselves into the crowd, with three of Havoc fighting them back, using a very limited supply of Sandman rounds. To confuse the math even more, this was the ultimate diplomatic nightmare. The security teams were critically aware that everyone around them represented a foreign government and, given this was a summit on nuclear weapons, a well-armed government. Shoot the wrong person, no matter what the circumstances, and the fallout would be devastating. So how does a guard keep his principal safe in that kind of circumstance? You tell me, because no one has ever trained for something like this. There is no response protocol for this on file. More gunfire crackled behind me, tearing the edge of the stage into a storm of flying splinters. I dove toward the American huddle and drove them down and back. I scrambled up, whirled, and saw more fixers coming in. I recognized them as the second maintenance crew from earlier, the tall man with the beard, the black-haired woman, and two others. They fired at the stage, bullets tearing into the guards, who tried to return fire but did not know where to shoot. I realized who they were, of course, even with the disguises. Adam and Eve. Hatred and hope surged up together in my chest. I wanted to end both of those psychos, but at the same time, they might know how to shut the sprayers off. Before I knew I was going to do it, I was in the air, leaping from the stage, landing, running. Adam and Eve laughed. Actually, laughed and whirled around, fleeing before me. Adam tore off his fake beard and flipped it arrogantly in my direction. Like a fool, I chased them. Chapter 132. D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. As I charged toward them, one of the others, a red-headed woman, went down as Eve shoved her into the path. Eve and Adam turned and ran. The fourth fixer tried to hold the door, to block me, to gun me down. I shot him in the face and one of the Sandman darts hit his eye. He started to shriek in agony, but then the drug slapped the scream from his mouth and dropped him. I vaulted his body but stopped at the doorway, crouching for a fast look, and immediately jerked my head back as a bullet chunked into the frame an inch from my eyebrow. I flung myself forward into the hall, rolling like a log, low to the floor, turning, bringing the gun up, but my quarry was already running away. They ran fast, shoving people aside. Eve shot two people and jerked them backward to block pursuit. I ran zigzag, shamelessly using people as cover. I could not let the blondes take me down. We ran through a crazy darkness filled with indistinct moving shadows, some of them painted with stark blue light from phones, throwing goblin shadows on the wall. It was a funhouse in some deeply twisted nightmare version of an amusement park. Nothing was real. And it was so strange, so deeply frightening that something as orderly, well-managed, and planned out as this summit could be torn to pieces so quickly. Control the lights, jam communications, rig the sprayers in the vents, and start a wave of violence. The summit had only been announced 4 months ago, so for this to have come off so smoothly, it spoke to an organization that was huge, subtle, well-funded, and tightly run. Kuga. The plague. Yes, very much that. So if Korea was a job for the Five Iron Men, who was the client for this? Was it Putin, looking for payback after he got spanked during the Deep Silence case? Or was this Kuga making a statement? Look at us. Look what we can do. Look at how powerful Hell's Concierge truly is. My gut said it was the latter, a statement piece that would never be forgotten. Even if the world leaders all survived, this would be talked about for 100 years. This attack, the rage disease launched against 9 world leaders, was the most audacious plan I've ever heard of. It would hit the global economy like an asteroid strike. Governments might fall. Blame would be hurled around before sense and sanity prevailed. The Korea thing had been bad enough and could have started a war, but this was the big play. This was an incalculable disaster, and we hadn't seen it coming in time. I felt like a fool, an imbecile. The pieces had been right there. Why hadn't I taken a better look? Christ, was all of this because of my arrogance? Because of my lack of vision? If so, every drop of blood was on me. Every ruined life, every crack in the globe was mine to own. Adam kicked open a door to a side corridor with me only steps behind. I bashed through, firing as I went. It was nearly pitch dark in there. My last dart missed Adam and hit a confused security guard who was blocking the exit door on the far side of the room. He dropped onto his face. Adam lost a half-second glancing at him, and that was enough time for me. I threw the Snellig and hit the back of his forearm. His gun went spinning and struck Eve in the mouth, splitting her lip. She was closer to me and tried to bring her gun around, but I took the long reach for a brutal overhand right and caught her in the side of the biceps with enough force to send her gun spinning through the air like a flying saucer. Eve wasted no time being surprised. The fat suit disguise she wore did not slow her down one little bit. She came at me quick as a cat, snapping out a kick intended to knock my kneecap loose. Very hard, very fast. I jerked my leg up and counter-kicked her with a ball of the foot to her hip that sent her stumbling back. As if they'd choreographed it, Adam jumped past her, slapping a hand against her shoulder to stabilize her as he came at me from a quarter angle. He threw huge hook punches, big ones that he swung from the floor, pivoting to put maximum power into right and left fists. I'd seen this kind of thing before. If you're smart, you build a cage of muscle and bone and try to ride it out. Try to be clever and counterpunch, and you're likely to catch a good one. He was fast as a snake and strong as a bull, but I tucked my head down behind my shoulder, kept my fists against my skull, and gave him nothing but elbows and the edges of bones to punch. As soon as the flurry began to slacken, I drove at him, using my forearms to shove at him back. Then I gave it to him with a bit more precision. A lot of quick injuries in different places can make a person feel like they've been tumbled into an industrial dryer filled with rocks. I stamped on his foot, thumbed him in the socket of his throat, popped a cupped palm against one ear, drove a single-knuckle punch into his left sinus, whipped him across the throat with a backhand blow of my fingers, and hooked him a heavy one in the floating ribs. He stumbled and dropped to his knees. As I'd hit him, I'd shifted around to try and put him between me and Eve. That saved me because she had one of the two fallen pistols. She brought it up fast and shot from the hip, but I shoved Adam toward her. Her bullet took him in the mouth. The big hollow point exploded his white teeth and shredded his lips and blew a hole the size of an apple out the back of his skull. Blonde hair, pieces of bone, gray brains, and bright red blood splashed my thigh and hips as the slug exited and burned past me. Eve stared in absolute, uncomprehending horror. And then she screamed, louder than I've ever heard anyone scream, a rising wail of total horror that was filled with unbearable loss. Still screaming, she swung the gun toward me, her finger jerking on the trigger, firing wildly, bullets filling the air. I dove in and down and forward and tackled her. The last round hit me on the side, slamming the Kevlar and then ricocheting off to hit Adam's corpse where it sat slumped against the wall. Eve was freaking out, torn apart by grief and shock and hate. She hammered at me with the butt of the pistol and caught me over the ear, dimming the lights for a moment, but I didn't let that stop me. I bashed the gun hand aside and hit her in the stomach about as hard as I've hit anyone in my life. I brought the punch up from the floor, pivoting for maximum velocity and depth of penetration, and the blow lifted her completely off the ground. She collapsed down on kneecaps and elbows, gagging, trying to breathe, and then vomited violently. I staggered to my feet, picked up the fallen gun, and checked it. The slide was locked back. I tossed it away. Through the open door to the hall, I could still hear screams and gunfire. Eve was writhing on the ground, weeping and trying to crawl to where Adam lay in a wretched sprawl. I bent and grabbed her by the collar and hauled her roughly to her feet and slammed her against the wall, clamping a hand around her slender throat. I bent close and heard the killer's icy voice speak to her. It was as if darkness itself spoke.
"You got one chance, kid, and that's to tell me how to stop this thing."
"Fuck you,"
she wheezed. Then she tried to kick me, but I punched her thigh with my other hand, hard, driving two knuckles deep into thigh meat and giving them a corkscrew twist. She screamed. I pulled her off the wall and slammed her back again, making her eyes go momentarily blank.
"How? Thump. Do. Thump. I. Thump. Stop. Thump. This. Thump."
I was not gentle. "I don't give a fuck." Her head hit the wall. She cried out in pain and protest. I lifted her to her toes and then completely off the ground, pinning her to the wall by sheer force and my grip on her throat.
She tried to hold out. Maybe she thought she could because she was a monster. It didn't work. It might have. Perhaps if she hadn't spent so much time proving to her victims that everyone breaks, she might have held out longer. But even in the dim light, Eve looked into my eyes and saw ugly things. She saw her own future and the horrors that were promised by the monster in me, which in that moment was bigger and less human than the one in her. Her hand fluttered, and at first I thought she was reaching for a gun in the oversized clothes she wore. I slapped her hand away and reached into the pocket, and there, nestled against the fake blubber, was a metal box. I removed it and recognized it as the same kind of jammer the SEALs had used on Yeonpyeong Island. I snatched it from her, letting Eve slide, coughing and spitting down the wall. There were several small switches below a row of red lights. I flipped them all and saw the lights go green, then winced as voices began yelling in my ear. "Havoc, Havoc, Havoc," I growled. "Havoc actual, jammer is down. Repeat, jammer is down." "Hoo-ah," called Bunny, but behind him I could hear more yells and shots. "Bug," I barked, "we need the lights on and we're in," he said quickly, and the room was flooded with fluorescent light. "I need those fucking vents shut down," I barked. "The entire air conditioning system, shut it all down." There was a pause as tight as a fist, and then Bug gasped. "Shutting it down now, but... shit, Outlaw, the blowers are still functioning. They must be connected to some other power source, something I can't get to remotely."
"Can't use that answer, Bug. Find me something."
"If you can keep that jammer off, I can keep the lights on, but you're on your own with the blowers. Sorry."
I dropped the jammer and stamped down hard enough to burst the device into fragments. It gave a single puff of smoke and then died. With the lights on, I was able to find Adam's gun and his two extra magazines. I took the sleeping guard's weapon, too. I looked at Eve, laying in a weeping pile, then went over and crouched in front of her. I placed the barrel of one of the guns under her chin and, despite resistance, made her raise her head and look at me.
"How do I stop this?"
I demanded. Eve shook her head. I placed the barrel of the pistol hard against her kneecap.
"I can make this last," I said. "You know that. So tell me right now, how do I stop this?"
Each blower is self-contained, battery-operated. You'd need to turn them off individually."
I gaped at her, my mind racing on to process that, and at the same time figure out how to stop the machines while taking fire from Santoro's crew. "How many fixers are in this building?"
30,
she said, tripping over it.
Shit. That was a lot. It was going to take so much to figure it out, to find the infiltrators.
"Are they all fixers, or are some of them under your thumb?"
"Oh, they're all fixers. A strike team."
I leaned closer and spat the next question.
"Where is Rafael Santoro?"
She stared at me but said nothing. Her mouth firmed in a way that told me she'd endure a lot before giving him up. I didn't think it was fear of the Spaniard. No, this was deeper, more ferocious. It was more like love, like a family thing. He was what they called him, Daddy. Shit. "Who is Kuga?" I asked. "Is he Harcourt Bolton?" There was a flicker on her face, a brief appearance of a line between her brows. Confusion, I think. No trace of recognition of that name.
"Where is Kuga?"
She licked her lips.
"Everywhere."
I gave her another thump. "Not the best time to be mysterious, kid. Where?"
I don't know. We only really ever see Daddy.
"Is he here? Is Santoro in this hotel?" Eve did not want to answer. She tried not to, but the killer was asking the questions and she could see him in my eyes. She nodded.
"Where?"
I asked.
"I don't know. He doesn't tell us where to find him. He finds us."
I pressed harder with the barrel. With my other hand, I tore off her black wig and saw that a slender wire mic was hidden by the hair.
"Is there a team channel?"
She nodded.
"What is the stand-down order?"
Her eyes shifted away. Some reserves of courage seemed to rise up in her, but she shook her head.
"Fuck you,"
she said, spitting the words at me. "I warned you," I said, and shot her through the knee. Her scream tore the air in half, rising to the supersonic. I placed the barrel against the other kneecap. That was as effective as a slap across the mouth. She stopped screaming and sat there, shaking, sweating, bleeding, terrified, staring at me.
"What is the fucking stand down order?"
Eve did not want to give me the code. For whatever such stubbornness or loyalty or stupidity is worth, she did not want to give it up. And yet... Chapter 133. D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. I didn't waste a Sandman dart or another bullet on her. I left her there to bleed. If she bled out, then what a damn shame that would be. "Bug," I said as I moved into the hall. People were running and yelling, some crouched down, but the rage pathogen did not seem to be out here. Small mercies. "I have one of the fixer's comm units attached to a booster unit. I need you to access their system and send the following message. Icarus falls. Repeat that back." "Good. I'm plugging the comms unit into my Q-box." The Q-box was a device the size of a deck of playing cards with various kinds of ports on three of the four sides. The unit I found in the WIG had a standard double-end cable, and I plugged that in. An encouraging little green light flicked on.
"Got it, Outlaw," said Bug.
"But whoa, there's some serious protection here, firewall and encryption. I don't care if it's guarded by dragons. Kick your way in and send that code." Eve said it was not a surrender order, but instead directed the strike team to exfil by any possible means. That was fine. Better than what was going on. It would give me a chance to pull people away from the sprayers and maybe enlist some of the security personnel into protecting the uninfected and corralling those driven mad with rage. "Bug, get Bedlam and Chaos teams in here. We're going to need a lot more Sandman."
"Be advised, Outlaw, that the hotel went into hard lockdown when the power went out. It's all on a private generator, and we have heavy seals on all the exterior doors. Bedlam is trying to breach the door, and Chaos is being airlifted to the roof."
"What about the vents?" I asked. "Can you shut down the blowers?"
"The AC is down, but Pappy confirmed the stuff is still blowing out at high speed. Unless you can access each vent and manually shut the units down, we may have to wait until their canisters are empty."
"Then send the shutdown code and get those fixers out of here."
"Working on it. Whoever wrote their security software is good. Really, really good."
I said some very ugly 10-letter words and ran for the main hall. A bleeding reporter staggered into my path and thrust a microphone toward me.
"Sir, are you state security? Can you give us an update on..."
I pushed him aside and kept running. The area around the entrance to the main hall was empty, except for three silent bodies and four men who stood in the doorway firing into the room. Two were dressed in maintenance coveralls, two were in black suits, like the one I wore. I took my gun in two hands and slowed to a fast walk, mindful that they all wore body armor, firing at the backs of their heads. 8 rounds, 4 dead fixers. Only the last one was able to turn, but my last round went through his temple. Then, I stepped into hell. There were many more of the infected now, and they were like a storm tide crashing against small islands of uninfected. Bodies lay everywhere. Many people were bleeding. Everyone was fighting. On the stage, three of the huddles were still there, inching their way toward the stage right exit. I saw more than a dozen dead guards. Church was up there, standing beside a kneeling Bell. Church had a regular handgun, while Bell still had her Snellig. Below them, in the orchestra pit, Top, Bunny, and Andrea were using bare hands to fight the infected. Heaps of unconscious people explained why they no longer had darts to fire. Those same darted people created a crude barrier that forced the attackers to come at them through a choke point at one end. And come they did. As the infected came in, the three fighters took turns tripping them, spinning them, clubbing them down, occasionally breaking a leg or an arm. Writhing infected were all around them. Bunny kept grabbing them and tossing their bodies onto the barricade. It was brutal work, and I could see that they were tiring. No one could maintain that kind of fight for long. I raced down the central corridor, bashing people out of my way. "Havoc, havoc, havoc!" I yelled as I vaulted the barricade. I pressed my Snelligan 2 magazines into Top's hand, then climbed up onto the stage close to the left side, out of the line of the shooters. I saw, to my amazement, that one of the huddles was the American president. He should have been second off. Then I saw that every man in his Secret Service detachment was injured, some badly. I could read what happened. They tried to get out and took a full fusillade, then retreated to the dubious safety closer to the rostrum. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw someone enter the room from the door I'd just used. He was dressed in maintenance coveralls, a short, slender man who moved with the oiled grace of a panther. He stopped, looked across the melee at me. We made eye contact. He smiled. Santoro. Right there. If anyone knew how to stop this, it would be him. If anyone knew what else was coming, what new horrors the Kuga organization was about to unleash, he would, and I needed to make him tell me. I began to shout his name, but then his hands came up holding a Colt Canada C7 assault rifle. It was not pointed at me, though. He aimed it at the stage. Not at the huddled world leaders, no. He opened fire on full auto at Mr. Church. I bellowed a warning, but not in time. I saw Church stagger, his clothes popping as the bullets hit him. Blood slapped the curtains behind him and splashed Bell. Mr. Church fell. Chapter 134. D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. I ran, screaming in fear and fury and despair, straight at Santoro. I fired at him until the slide locked back, but he was moving, dodging and turning, the way good soldiers are taught to move. He was trying to swap in a new magazine, but someone blundered into him and the mag went flying, so instead he threw the weapon at me with great force and accuracy. I clubbed it aside with my empty pistol. Santoro ran for the exit, bashing people aside, hitting them with crippling blows and flinging them behind him to hamper pursuit. A Fox reporter staggered toward me, clutching a shattered nose. A Pakistani reporter dropped to her knees in front of me, eyes bulging as her desperate fingers clawed at a smashed throat. I had to shove her aside and stop the murderous madman. This was not a time for mercy. It was a time for murder. Santoro burst into the hallway and kicked the door shut in my face. I was moving so fast there was no time to stop. It was like hitting a brick wall. I rebounded, staggered, nearly fell, caught myself by grabbing the shoulder of a screaming dignitary. "Sorry," I said, but then the man lunged for my throat with his teeth. Fuck. I backpedaled and swung a heavy right to smash the heel of my palm against his ear. The blow sent him sprawling into the arms of another infected. They fell, thrashing and snarling, to the ground. I jumped over them and kicked the door, expecting it to be locked or braced. It flew inward so quickly I almost fell on my face, and that fall saved my life, as a blade sliced through the space where my eyes had just been. As I hit the ground, I rolled sideways and kicked up with both feet, catching Santoro in the knee and stomach, and sent him reeling backward. He hit the edge of the doorway and used the jolt to reclaim his balance. I rolled away again to avoid a stamp that would have crushed my throat. I kept rolling, and then on the fourth turn I crunched my body and was on fingers and toes. Santoro was too smart a fighter to charge and shifted hard left, dropping into the springy crouch of the master knife fighter. I pushed back off my hands and grabbed for my Wilson Rapid Response folding knife, which was clipped to the inside of my right pants pocket. A sharp snap of my wrist locked the 3.5-inch blade into place. My knife's total weight is less than 5 ounces, which reduces drag. I could use it at my normal hand speed, and I am a very fast fighter. We faced each other, eyes meeting, knowing each other. We'd fought once before. Years ago, aboard the Sea of Hope. I'd never fought a tougher opponent, and even with Ghost's help, the little bastard nearly killed us both. There was that one moment of stillness and awareness. Then he came at me with a flurry of vicious cuts, fake stabs followed by shallow slashes and devious feints that drove me back 6 full steps. I cut left and then jumped right and tried to take him with a deep cut on the back of his knife arm, but all I got was sleeve.
"The Deacon is dead," he said as he circled with me. "That alone makes today a beautiful holiday, a sacred day."
He was trying to bait me, to make me angry enough to do something stupid. "And when you go back to Harcourt Bolton to brag, will he pat you like a good puppy and give you treats?" I looked for surprise or recognition, but he was too good a player and gave me nothing.
"You should have stayed in America," he said.
He faked a lunge to try and make me go for a countercut. I fake flinched and snapped a shallow kick, hoping he'd try and cut my leg. It didn't work any better than his fake. We were too evenly matched for those kinds of tricks. Mind you, part of me was in shock, maybe starting to grieve for Church. I could not imagine the world without him. Certainly the RTI needed his vision, his strength, his guidance to do the kind of work we were there to do. The world needed him, and he was family to me, though we would never say such things aloud. There was the family, which was made up of trusted allies in our war, but he was family on a deeper level. If he was dead, I don't know how we could survive it. Maybe we wouldn't. But those thoughts were in the back of my mind. The cop and the modern man could handle the potential loss. The killer had work to do, and he wanted this man's blood. He wanted to tear the heart from Santoro's chest and chase the light from the Spaniard's eyes. Santoro fainted, double fainted, and came in with unbelievable speed, ducking low and slashing at my leg from an unexpected angle. His blade was razor sharp, and suddenly there was a line of fire across the outside of my right leg. If I'd tried to backpedal, he'd have gutted me, so I closed with him, slamming chest to chest with him, using my greater weight and the angle of my upper body mass against his slimmer, shorter body to jolt him backward off balance. It earned me a second slash because even off balance he was that fast. However, the angle was wrong for a lethal cut, and his blade merely gouged my hip and sliced through the Velcro holding my vest on beneath my shirt and suit coat. I headbutted him and slashed him across the throat, but he brought a forearm up and took the cut there. I felt my blade hit bone, but he was moving the arm, and his balled fist caught me on a nerve cluster at the end of my wrist. My hand went numb, and I lost the knife. He tried to stab me to end it right there, drilling his knife upward under my chin, but the proximity of our bodies foiled the thrust, and instead his blade caught in my lapel. I headbutted him again, and he staggered back without his knife. I heard it tinkle to the floor. Then he kicked me and I twisted to take it on the hip, saving my groin but getting knocked back against a row of chairs. The mad screeching of the infected was rising in volume, drowning out everything except the gunfire. I straightened, feeling an alarming weakness in my injured leg. He'd gotten a muscle. Shit! We were both bleeding now and unarmed. He flicked a glance at the stage and the exit. Bell was kneeling over Church, firing and firing. Was there less return fire? I couldn't tell. "What's the point of all this?" I demanded. "What's the goddamn win here for you motherfuckers? Since when are you political, Raphael?" He laughed.
"Political? I spit on politics," he said,
and did.
"Then why? At least tell me that."
His dark eyes were filled with a strange light, and he frowned, as if surprised at the naivete of my question.
"Does there need to be a cause? Does there need to be an ideology? You went to war for the goddess. I waged war for the 7 kings," he corrected. "My love for the goddess was separate. As for this," he waved his good arm at the crowd and the stage, this is business. A happy, peaceful world does not need people like me. This world does."
"Business," I said, inching to my left, favoring my good leg.
"That's all Kuga is? A fucking businessman?"
"Of course,"
What else? How are you naive enough not to grasp that?
All this damage. All this pain. Jesus Christ, I said. What the fuck is wrong with you?
He did not answer. Instead, he rushed at me, lunging, pivoting, attempting a Muay Thai kick to my bad leg that would have dropped me. I knew it was what he'd do. It was the best possible move, and he counted on his appalling speed to sell it. I sucked in my gut and skipped both feet back like a matador, avoiding a low slash with a bull's horn, and as the foot missed by a millimeter, I drilled a punch into the side of his calf, into the meat, packing all of my 215 pounds of muscle, all my fury and heartbreak and fear into that blow. He cried out in agony and dropped down at my feet, but even hurt like that, he was a scorpion at heart. He'd fight as long as there was breath in his body. He used his slashed forearm to chop my bad leg, buckling it. I tottered sideways, fighting for balance. Then he piled on me, smashing me across the face with his bloody forearm, obscuring my vision. Unlike Adam, who'd tried to smash me to pieces, Santoro was much smarter and more skilled. He tried to do to me what I'd done to his apprentice and rained down awful blows to fragile targets. He straddled me and hit, hit, hit. He smashed my nose and split my lip and hammered my left eye socket apart. I could feel my face burst apart, feel bone cracking and cartilage crunching. I felt two teeth break. I was blind, and I was losing this fight. In my head, the killer roared in mingled fear and fury. The thing about beating someone like me to death is that you have to take their heart to make it work. One slip, one missed blow, one inadvertent mercy because of choosing the wrong target was a doorway for counterattack. He had a moment's advantage where he could have and should have killed me. He could have used the punch that knocked out my teeth to crush my throat. He really should have. But he wanted to make it last. He was trying to hurt me before he killed me, to defeat me because I had defeated him. That was his mistake. I tucked my chin and turned to one side and took his next punch on my cheekbone. I could feel his knuckles shatter. I spit my broken teeth into his face, bucked my hips, and rolled sideways, slamming my left hip against the inside of his right leg. The leverage toppled him sideways, and I gave his body a vicious twist, driving that same hip into his crotch. I did not need to see him. We were touching, entwined in a sick embrace, and I could extrapolate where every part of him was. I grabbed his crotch with my left hand and used my right to punch my palm just about as hard as I could. It was a hideous, smashing, crushing overhand right that caught his scrotum between knuckles and palm. He howled as loud as Eve had screamed. I caught him by the hair and rammed his face into the floor, once, twice, again, and again, breaking him. For Church, and Colonel Ho, for everyone on those islands, for every dead child and family, for the blood of my friends, and for strangers whose names I would never know. I blinked my eyes clear and saw the ruin of him. I pulled what was left of him close to me so that my bleeding mouth was against his bloody ear. "Die, you evil little motherfucker!" I wheezed and slammed his face onto the floor again. Suddenly the air above and around me was filled with gunfire. Bullets tore stone chips from the floor and walls. One ricocheted off the marble and struck me hard in the floating ribs. I fell sideways, losing my grip on Santoro. At the far end of the corridor, I could see a group of fixers running toward a service exit. Others joined them. A mass exodus. Bug must have cracked the system and issued the shutdown code. The rats were fleeing the sinking ship. But there was more gunfire behind me, and I wheeled drunkenly around to see a squad of men and women in dark suits running in a cluster, firing past me at them. I pawed blood from my eyes and saw that the person in the lead was Steve Duffy, my old Echo Team sniper. Which meant this was Bedlam Team and the goddamn cavalry had arrived. Something splashed me in the face and I recoiled, spitting and cursing, and looked right up at the liquid vapor spewing from the vent on the wall 3 feet above my head. As I stared, the spray twitched, dwindled, and then died as the tanks concealed behind the vent went dry, empty. Done. I turned to see that most of the other vents had already stopped. I saw Santoro crawling away from me. He was laughing. I laughed, too. Except it wasn't a laugh. What came from my mouth was a full-throated roar of pure, savage, intense rage. Chapter 135 D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. My vision changed from clarity to crimson distortion. I saw monster shapes all around me, leering, slavering beasts who wanted to kill me. They came at me with fangs and black talons. There was a black knot of fear deep inside my chest, but it was buried beneath a thousand layers of fury. There was no Santoro, no Eve, no Kuga, and no fixers, no Bedlam team either. There was no church or bell, no top bunny or Andrea, no presidents or guards or press or civilians. I staggered into a big room to where people were fighting. It made me happy. It made me mad. I should be doing this, all of it, the stabbing and biting. That was mine to do. Mine. All there were, everywhere I looked, were people I hated. No, more than hated, despised with every fiber of who I was. It was a loathing that tunneled down into my DNA, into my soul. I saw a big man on the stage. Familiar, I knew him and hated him more than all the others. He was bleeding from gunshot wounds, but still sitting up, still firing a gun, the bastard. I despised everything about him. He needed to be stopped. He needed to die. I ran toward him. Something was wrong with my leg. I could not run as fast as my hate. God, I wanted to kill them all. Now, in bad ways, in ugly, ugly ways that would ruin them and everyone who loved them. My muscles were tight with the need to hurt them. The pain in my side and my leg, that was fuel for the fire that burned inside of me. I found my knife on the floor and snatched it up with a howl of triumph. Sweet, beautiful knife, red and silver and perfect. Now I could do it. Now I could cut into them, cut them apart, cut the evil from them and rub it all over me. I wanted, needed to bathe in their blood, to drink it and spit it back in their faces. I wanted to crack their bones open and suck out the marrow. I ran toward the injured man, howling at him, telling him the things I was going to do to him. I wanted to paint the walls with the red lies of their lives and...
Sorry, boss,
said a voice, and Bell, that hateful bitch who deserved to die like the backstabbing traitor she was, pointed a gun at me and fired. I swung my knife forward, stabbing, wanting to bury my blade into her traitorous heart, and... Chapter 136 D9 Conference, Radisson Blue Plaza Hotel, Oslo, Norway. I woke in semi-darkness.
Every goddamn thing hurt. My leg, my side, my mouth, my face, my body... My heart.
Images lingered in my head. Top Sims, Duffy, Adam and Eve, Santoro, Church, others. Their faces seemed weirdly overlaid with distorted Halloween mask versions of them. Even the familiar faces of friends had loathsome monster masks superimposed. As I stared, though, the freak masks faded and faded. I lay on a couch in an empty office, zip-cuffed, heavily bandaged, an IV drip hanging from a pole, too much pain to catalog. Shadows in my mind. A clock on the wall insisted it was the wrong time of day. It said that it was evening, but how is that even possible?
Hey,
I called. No answer, so I yelled it. Yelling hurt my mouth. It hurt everything. My soul. There were footsteps outside, and then the door opened. Violins stood there, tall, lovely, intense, her long hair falling loosely to frame her patrician face, eyes filled with concern.
Hello, Joseph,
she said. Hello, Violin? She came in, pulled a chair over, and sat next to me, searching my face.
Is it you in there?
As opposed to, oh, I said, and that quickly I understood. Rage?
Oh, yes. They tell me you got it full in the face.
Christ. Please tell me I didn't kill anyone. She smiled and shook her head.
You tried to stab Belle. She had a dart gun.
Is she okay?
She is. Though, I think you should buy her something nice for Christmas.
My words were slurred from pain, swollen tissue, and two missing teeth.
And George? I remember seeing him there. I had a knife.
Her smile dimmed.
Saint-Germain is alive. You never reached him. He has been medevaced out, though. He was shot in the thigh, lower back, the chest, and left arm. A lot of blood loss, but he was still fighting the whole time, still protecting the presidents when Chaos Team found him.
She laughed and shook her head, making her hair sway.
I don't know what it would take to actually kill him.
Yes, his body armor saved him, I said. We have pretty good stuff. I got hit a couple of times.
Violin laughed.
He wasn't wearing body armor, Joseph. He is simply lucky. Strangely, consistently lucky. He has been taken to a local hospital where, no doubt, he has friends among the doctors and specialists there.
He'll live?
Oh, yes, Josephine. He'll live,
she said, her smile enigmatic.
I know for a fact he has been hurt much worse than this in the past.
I looked at her.
How much do you know about him? About his past? Maybe who he really is, or what he is?
Her smile faded except for a tiny Mona Lisa curve.
He is a good man, Joseph, but make no mistake. He is a man. He's no angel or demon or anything else. People tend to mythologize about him, but he is flesh and blood.
I said nothing, mostly because I knew she was lying, but not which parts of what she said were a lie, so instead I raised my cuffed wrists.
Mind?
Violin drew a slender blade from inside a sleeve and cut me loose, then helped me sit up. My exploring fingers found a turban of gauze wrapped around my head. I could see brown antiseptic goop around the cuts on my hands and a red-soaked dressing on my thigh. When I tapped my pocket, I found a Ziploc baggie with my two broken teeth in it.
I could use an aspirin.
I'll see what I can arrange,
she said.
You're on the list for the hospital, but they've triaged you as lower priority. There are a lot of badly injured people here. My team was outside when this all happened. The hotel went into full lockdown, and it took considerable time to get in. We were able to assess the situation thanks to intel from top, relayed through bug. My people took down a number of fixers attempting to leave and helped Havoc with controlling the infected.
I rubbed my eyes. They were grainy and blurry, and the room was a bit too bright.
I think I have a concussion.
I'd be surprised if you did not.
There was a lot of noise beyond the closed door, people dealing with what happened.
Did we win?
She smiled.
They won't give anyone a parade, but yes, Joseph, we won.
What's the butcher's bill?
Her sigh was long and slow and weary.
It's bad, Joseph, it's very bad.
At the beginning of the conference, there had been a total of 3,019 people in the hotel. Diplomatic and presidential teams, hotel staff, press, security, and others. Of those, 91 had been sprayed with rage. Between the fixers' gunfire and the attacks by the infected, there were 137 dead and almost twice as many injured. 11 critical. Of the 9 world leaders, 7 were unharmed, 1 had been injured in the hand by a ricochet, and 1 had been bitten on the face by one of his own guards. Almost every member of the 9 security teams sustained injuries, and a 3rd had died protecting their principals. There was a knock on the door and Scott Wilson came in, looking tentatively at me and my uncuffed hands.
"He's fine now,"
said Violin. She bent and gave me a light kiss on the top of the head, patted Wilson's shoulder, and left. Scott sat in her chair. He gave me the rest of it. Once the jammers went back on, some of the people inside the main hall had started using cell phones or press cameras to record the incident. They didn't help people or try to find safety. They grabbed the story instead, for their networks or, in many cases, for their own social media feeds. Stuff like that can make you hate people. But, as Wilson explained, it did some good. Wilson controlled the message and was able to use the network of contacts he and Church maintained to make sure the right story got out. There had been a terrorist attack on the D9 summit. The terrorist organization called itself Kuga and was believed to be a criminal rather than ideological group. Kuga used a bioweapon that caused violent outbursts on the crowd. They also had active shooters there to attempt assassinations of all 9 world leaders. Only the combined efforts of the well-trained and thoroughly professional security teams of the 9 nations and the host country of Norway prevented a disaster from being even worse than it was. "There will be speeches and medals," Wilson told me. "None of the 9 presidents was seen to be acting in any cowardly way. All of the security personnel looked like heroes." "And the fallout?" "Don't expect another nuclear summit anytime soon," he said glumly. "So after all this shit, from Syria to Korea to here, Kuga wins?" Wilson gave an eloquent sniff, very Eton. "If his goal was assassination, then no," he said slowly. "However, if it was to stop the D9 summit, then yes." "We don't know which, though," I said. "No. Quite frankly, Colonel, this feels a bit like Pearl Harbor, a sneak attack that lets us know we're at war with an empire." "Shit. If you were hoping for a big dramatic finale, this is not that. We won, but only on a sliding scale. It was pretty clear they wanted to assassinate as many of the 9 world leaders as possible. 10 if you count the Prime Minister of Norway. They failed in that, and may actually have strengthened the unity of those nations. So, if we view it through that lens, this is a great victory. But it is a battle won, not a war." "Santor told me that this was all just business," I said. The bitterness was clear in my voice, slurred speech or not. Wilson nodded. "Very big business, to be certain. As soon as the story broke, the global stock markets plummeted, of course, until trading was suspended. I have no doubt Kuga was positioned to profit from the first wave of flight to safety. Depending on how many people he had positioned to buy as the stocks dropped, and depending on how well they are concealed, he could have scored billions today."
"Jesus Christ. That could have been their whole damn plan in the first place."
"Yes," he said bleakly, "it could have. A gigantic con game to create a massive stock market price drop. If so, then we really have lost. The stock market swing would have been the same whether we saved presidential lives or not. It was the failure of D9 that ignited the sell-off. There is already an uptick in black market and open market arms sales. I expect there will be an even greater uptick in hiring of private security." I lean my forearms on my thighs, feeling old and used and empty.
You didn't arrest Santoro, did you?
I asked.
No.
Sergeant Duffy said he saw two fixes helping him out of the hole, but couldn't get to him. Santoro is gone. So, by the way, is Eve. We did manage to arrest three fixes, and they are being interrogated, but it doesn't appear that they know enough. He went to the door and paused.
Kuga is still out there.
So now, we begin preparing for what comes next.
The war is the war, I said.
He studied me for a moment, nodded, and left. Chapter 137. The Ledger Country House, Robinwood, Maryland, December 24th, 11:41 a.m. The war was the war, but it was over for me, for now. Because of my exposure to rage and because neither Doc nor John Smarr knew if there were any lasting effects, I was put on administrative duty. But then a message came from Mr. Church to tell me that I had the holidays off. I called the private hospital where he was recovering from surgery and was surprised to be put through.
Hey, boss, I said. How the hell are you?
Alive, he said. And you?
Alive.
I cleared my throat. Look, with you on the sidelines, maybe it's better that I stick around the talk for a while just to, you know, keep the search going. Colonel, said Church in a tone that held no hint of weariness, injury, or weakness. The world is quite capable of turning without you constantly needing to push. Ouch, I said. Go spend Christmas with your family, said Church. Give them my love. Before I could say anything else, the line went dead. I'd made that call from my own hospital room. I was covered in stitches and staples and tape and looked like a reject from a Frankenstein movie. They were going to fit me with a bridge to replace the missing teeth. The concussion was still ringing my chimes. My face was the color of a ripe eggplant, but it was Christmas, and nobody wanted me to go shoot anyone. Not at the moment. Which is why I was in a car with Junie, driving down country lanes in Maryland. The leafy trees were all bare, but the pines were a rich, dark green under a sky littered with cotton candy clouds. Ghost sat on the edge of the back seat, his big white head leaning forward onto the armrest between Junie, who drove, and me. Ghost's eyes drifted to me over and over again in the hope that something yummy would magically appear in my hand, as it often did.
He's going to get fat,
scolded Junie. He's not fat. He's big-boned. We drove. Since my return from Oslo, she and I had spent a couple of nights doing little more than holding each other. Frankly, because I was incapable of anything else. There were days filled with deep conversations and long, comfortable silences. She knew that I was working things out. Junie is one of those rare people who knows when talk is good and when silence is better. In the big rental SUV behind us were Rudy and Cersei, their son, and Top, and Banshee, their Irish wolfhound, two of Banshee's puppies, who looked suspiciously like Ghost, were in the back. Both cars were filled with wrapped presents. Bunny was back in California with his fiancée, Lydia, who was 6 months pregnant. Belle was in Egypt with Arclight, and I have no idea what they were doing. Andrea and his husband had taken their daughter to a little villa in Tuscany. Bug and Annie Hahn were, I was surprised and delighted to hear, holed up in a swanky bed and breakfast in Santorini. Poor Scott Wilson was working, running the ever-expanding global search for anyone connected with the Kuga organization, and making inroads. Hitting a lot of dead ends, too. He had not yet established that Harcourt Bolton was Kuga. We all believed that, but there were too many mysteries, some pieces that were left out of the puzzle. One interesting turn of events was that Major Munn had applied to RTI. I hadn't yet met her and wanted to. She seemed like a good fit for us. Mun wanted to be part of any hunt for Rafael Santoro, no matter where it led. That, though, was for another day. It was Christmas Eve, and there was even a chance for a white Christmas, corny as that sounds. Corny seemed really appealing at the moment. On the car radio, Josh Groban was singing Oh Holy Night. Corny too, but kind of nice.
Here we are,
said Junie, turning off the road onto a winding drive. The house looked cheery and right out of a Christmas card, down to the green wreath on the red-painted door. A FedEx truck was parked on the far side of the crushed shell turnaround, and I saw the driver trudging toward it. He wore a huge white costume beard and a Santa hat with a bouncing pom-pom. In the doorway, I caught a glimpse of Sean holding a big box. He saw us coming, grinned, and hurried to take the box inside so he could come out for handshakes and hugs. The FedEx driver, a smiling little guy with mirrored sunglasses, gave us a cheery wave and a huge, pleasant smile. He had one of those port wine skin discolorations, a fire mark, my grandmother called them, that was every bit as dark as my bruised mug. Junie tooted at him as he drove away. We parked, and I got out, careful of my leg, which was healing but sore as hell. Ghost bounded ahead but stopped on the bottom porch step, sniffing at something. As Junie and I approached, I saw that it was a folded piece of paper. Drop the delivery receipt, I said, and picked it up. When I opened it, I saw that it wasn't a receipt at all, just a note, written in flowing and elegant scripts. You have taken something of mine. Now I will take something of yours. Merry Christmas. My blood went instantly cold. I turned to see the FedEx truck hit the blacktop and accelerate away with a scream of tires. I turned back, seeing in my mind the big box Sean had carried inside. It looked heavy. The Santa wore a beard and glasses, not a fire mark discoloring him, but facial bruising. I opened my mouth to scream my brother's name, and the house blew up. Epilogue 1. The world was a white too bright to look at. Then it turned orange and I felt it burn me. After that it was all painted in featureless black. Then red. A dark red that smelled of copper. I blinked and the red was everywhere, in my eyes, on my hands when I lifted them. When I turned my head, I saw Ghost lying there. His white coat was red, too. He was panting weakly, eyes staring at nothing, tongue lolling. I turned my head the other way. It hurt to do it. There was something wrong with my neck. Junie lay there only a few feet away. Might as well have been the far side of the moon. She was also painted red. Her mouth worked like a dying fish, gasping, trying to speak. There were pieces of wood, splinters thick as my little finger, standing up from her chest and stomach and thighs. I saw her turn to me. It took a million years. Her hand twitched. It crawled toward me like a broken spider. I made my hand move toward hers. Our fingers met, entwined, locked. We held on to each other. Beyond her was the house. No. That was wrong. There was no house anymore. There was nothing but a place of broken stone and burning wood. The arms of the fire reached all the way into the sky. I tried to say the names. Sean, Allie, M, Lefty, Dad. Tried to speak them, but I had no voice, and those names weighed too much. The fire swirled upward, taking their souls away from me. 2. Somewhere millions of miles away, I heard a muffled sound. Car doors slamming, voices calling, yelling. Top, Rudy, Cersei, screaming. I heard my own voice screaming the loudest. 3. I don't remember all of it. They say that even burned and bloody with 8 broken ribs, a broken nose, lacerations everywhere, I kept Top and Rudy and 4 firemen busy trying to keep me from entering the conflagration of my uncle's house. They say that helicopters came to take Junie to a hospital for emergency surgery, and an ambulance took Ghost away for the same. They say that I broke away, snatched Top's gun, and ran down the road screaming Santoro's name. Top had to drop me with a Sandman dart. They say that there is justice in the world, and that the good guys always win in the end. They say. 4. Doctors repaired the parts of me that could be fixed. Rudy did not try to tell me everything was going to be okay. He's not that unkind. He told me he would be with me and that he would help me. He wrapped his arms around me and we wept together. Even Cersei joined us. So many tears, but no way to douse the flames that would burn forever. Mr. Church flew in and sat with me by Junie's bedside, his hand resting on my forearm, for hours, days, watching machines beep and ping, watching digital readouts insist that she was alive. She hovered there on the edge for so long. But then that remarkable strength of hers won out, and she came back to me. By slow degrees, she came back. When she was able to open her eyes and speak my name, just that one word was filled with more sadness and awareness than the world could hold. Church, swathed in bandages, was wheeled out and left us alone, and in our privacy, Junie and I let the world break around us. 5. People had to sift through the charred debris to find my father, my brother Sean, his wife Allie, the 2 kids, and the unborn baby. Doc Holliday took care of the identification with DNA sequencing. No one was cruel enough to ask me to look at what was left. Jerry Spencer arrived and took over the forensic collection. Whatever he found was shared with Wilson and Church, not with me. There are no ledgers left. My family line ended right there. Junie can't have kids, which means we won't have any. The ledgers are done. Because Sean was a cop and Dad had been the mayor of Baltimore, the funeral was immense. Thousands of people. A motorcade of flashing lights more than a mile long. Folded flags and guns fired in volleys. Pipers in kilts playing Amazing Grace. Top and Bunny made sure that the press did not get within a quarter mile of the church. I sat in the front row with Junie, who was still in a wheelchair, beside me. All of Havoc Team was there. Rudy and Cersei were there. Major Munn and Colonel Epps were there. Violin and Lilith sat behind me, and both of them put hands on my shoulder when I began to lose it. Other old friends, colleagues from my own days as a cop, former DMS agents, Bug and Annie Hahn, so many others. I have no idea what the minister said, or what any of the people who came up to speak said. Bunny helped me up to the podium, and I stood for several long minutes as silence owned the church. Then I shook my head, and he let me lean on him as he took me back to Junie. We buried them in a row, 5 neat headstones, 5 futures stolen, 5 holes in the world in the shape of my family. 6. What do you do when they turn off all the lights? All of your lights. I asked myself that every day. As I healed, as I threw myself into rehab and reclaimed my strength, I took that question with me to the dojo and the firing range. What do you do when they turn off all your lights? On a cold day in mid-February, I sat with Church in his office at Phoenix House. I knew he was looking for Santoro and Kuga. He was looking harder than anyone has ever looked for anyone. All of the resources of Rogue Team International, the field agents, the mind reader team, our network of allies around the globe, they were not looking hard enough because Santoro's head was not on a spike. Neither was Kuga's, whether he was Harcourt Bolton or not. Church and I sat there saying next to nothing for a long, long time. Then he said, "Whatever resources you need, whatever clearances, whatever freedom of action, Joe, you will have them." Joe, not Colonel Ledger. I nodded and got slowly to my feet. So much of me hurt, and so little of that pain was from the injuries. Burns heal, bones knit. I took my pain and stood looking out the window. I didn't say a goddamn word. My hands hung at my sides, and every now and then my fingers twitched as if aching to close around guilty throats. Church said, "Good hunting." 7. What do you do when they turn off all your lights? You learn to use the darkness. No. No, that's not it. That's not enough, not for me. Not for my family, not for all the families who lost people to these bastards. What do you do when they turn off all your lights? I'll tell you. You become the darkness. The end. This is Ray Porter. We hope you've enjoyed Rage, a Joe Ledger and Rogue Team International novel, a Macmillan audio production from St. Martin's Griffin. This title was produced by Katie Robitsky. Text copyright 2019 by Jonathan Mayberry. Production copyright 2019 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.